Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN and veterinary behaviorist Dr. Amy Pike, also a podcaster, is right here. The name of the book is called Dog Parenting, an illustrated guide to understanding, training, and bonding with your best friend. And by the way, Dr. Pike, a veterinary behaviorist, I need to say this book is one of those mini books that has a lot packed into it. It's a small
Thanks.
Book with big information in it. And you didn't do this alone. Elizabeth Mullen, Tara Murtaugh helped you. The illustrations by Finn Kendall are really more than important. They're a lot of fun in many cases.
Aren't they adorable?
Yeah.
He did such a great job.
Yeah. But the other thing is, like, and we'll talk a little bit about this. I mean, when I write stories, I have to explain, well, a prong collar looks like a cartoon dog. I mean, so you actually show of what that is, so people know, as one example. And by the way, we don't want you to use any of those things. And we'll
It was on the no list.
But before we get to that, I want to talk about the title of the book. It's called Dog Parenting. Now, had you been much older and this book was written generations ago, it might have been called Dog Ownership, I suppose.
Yeah.
And it's about training and bonding with your best friend. Are our dogs truly born to be our best friends? That's a big question out of the box.
Gosh, that is a big question. I mean, no, that's not their purpose in life, right? But that's how we, you know, that's why we get pets, right, is to be our best friend, to have that companionship. And, but also I think a lot of people, you know, generationally are not necessarily replacing children with dogs, but a lot of, you know, a lot of people are choosing not to have kids. And so they really do view their pet as their child. Now, they are not children. Which is actually, it was one of the arguments between me and my co-authors. I was like, I don't want to anthropomorphize the dog too much. But we, you know, we know that a lot of our clients do really view their pet as part of the family. And so that's kind of why we went with dog parenting.
Which makes a lot of sense. So the first thing you talk about is training the dog. They're not born right out of the box to pay necessarily attention to you in the way you'd want. Notice I carefully word that because dogs are hardwired, I believe, to understand us to some extent. Yeah. Having said that, they don't come out of the box trained, quote unquote.
Right.
And
right.
And one of the first...
Nor do they speak English either. So
well,
like that's
right.
The other thing that we need to teach them is how to speak our language.
Exactly where I'm going. So you say the first thing to teach your dog is... I think you use the word look, it could be watch me, whatever the term is. The idea is you're actually training your dog, for starters, before you train your dog to do all these other things you write about, to pay attention to you.
Yep. Yep, exactly. Because that's so important because, you know, a lot of people, when they get their pet, right, they want to do the sit, the down, the... your basic, like, obedience stuff. But if you can get your pet to look at you and to really then focus on what are we doing, I can redirect them from being reactive. I can get them to look at me before we cross the street. So they're not just racing out. There's just so many practical things that we can use with the look or the watch me cue.
But how do they know, the dogs, that, this is what they want? You call it marking behavior.
Yeah.
What is that and how do you teach it?
Yeah, so marking behavior is a training technique where we literally use either some noise or a word to basically tell the dog that at that moment is exactly what behavior I wanted from you. So, you know, we've probably all seen those, you know, dolphin shows and you know, things and where they use a whistle to mark the behavior for the dolphin that, like, that is exactly what I wanted you to do. Well, we can use a clicker. You know, clicker training is a really common marker way, but we can also just use our voice. And so, you know, one of the things that we find with our clients is we want to keep it as simple as possible. And we always have our voice. We don't always have our clicker. So if we just use the word yes in a high-pitched, happy voice, which is why we put the exclamation mark after the yes throughout the book, because we want it to be really, really positive. And that basically, I think of our marker word is like camera. I'm taking a picture of the behavior to tell the dog that is exactly what I wanted from you. And then I'm going to reward them every single time they hear that word.
Some people say it's bribery. You support the notion of, well, maybe it is in a way, but is it all bad? Go ahead.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think of it as like a paycheck, right? Like, I love my job. I absolutely love being a veterinary behaviorist, but I'm going to be honest, if my clients didn't pay me, I probably wouldn't go. So is that bribery, or is that, you know, what is that? It's a reward for doing what you're supposed to do, and that's what this is about.
And how do we choose what that reward is? I mean, for some dogs, it might not be treats. For other dogs, yeah, treats, but not the same treat as that other dog. How do you know?
Exactly. Yeah, you might have to do a little cafeteria and decide, you know, let the dog choose what it wants. Like my one dog loves dried banana chips. I mean, he will do anything for dried banana chips. My other dog is not very food motivated, but he will murder somebody for me for a Kong tennis ball. Like, he is so obsessed with his Kong tennis balls. Shout out to Kong.
So, okay.
You know, you really just have to know your pet, and you can kind of see give them options and see what they pick.
All right. So I want to talk about training equipment, but it's interesting in the book, your book, Dog Parenting, what comes, and maybe there isn't an order here, but I take it that there is. Mm-hmm. One of your tips before you get to equipment is to teach place. Is a place that important?
You know, I like place as a behavior, not because I want my dog to be a robot and obedient and go to a spot every time, but I think it also kind of serves as like a, you know, I need to open the door, so you go to your place, and that way you're not darting out the door on me. It also can be a really great place for the dog to for the dog to kind of decompress. Like, we want it to be a really positive thing for that animal. And so having their little place, you know, whether that be a mat or whatever, I think it's a good skill to have. And then we can also, especially if it's a mobile place, like a, you know, a bath rug or something like that, we can take it to the vet's office. And then it's like we have that comfort piece from home. So it's one of the earliest behaviors that we do work on.
Yeah, that's excellent. And how many dogs do you have, Dr. Pike?
Mm-hmm. Personally?
Yeah.
Currently, I have four.
Uh-oh. All right. So you have four dogs, and you have two-leggeds, right? You have kids.
Yep. I have two-leggeds, a daughter who's about to go off to college, and a son who's in middle school. I have a Devon Rex cat, as you know.
Yes.
I have a Indian ringneck parakeet named Pavlov, and I have two clinic kitties who are both Devon Rexes, and we have chickens. I have a zoo.
All right. It's, first of all, amazing you even have time to talk to me for this conversation with all that.
Fair.
But when we come back, I will explain why I asked that question. And we will also talk about training methods, something that somehow, some way, has become controversial. We'll do that with Dr. Amy Pike next on WGN. She is a veterinary behaviorist. Dr. Amy Pike is one of the authors, co-author of Dog Parenting, An Illustrated Guide to Understanding Training and Bonding with Your Best Friend. All right. Now, Dr. Pike, before we went to break, I asked you how many pets you have, and you rattled off so many, I didn't even have time to ask the question which would follow that, because it seems like you have 4,000 in your home. So here's my question.
My husband thinks so, anyway.
Oh, you didn't mention him. All right. So, So here's the question. Does each individual pet maybe except the pet parrot, but in a sense, including the parrot, do they all need, including your two kids, I suppose, and most of all yourself, a place to get away from everyone and everything else? And it's really the dogs I'm most – do all dogs need – a private place that dog can go where the other household members, the kids, are not there, and other dogs may not even be there?
Yeah, I think they do because, you know, just like us, like you said, I need some privacy too. And that's hard in my household considering how many animals and humans live in it. But we all need that alone time to kind of decompress. And that's another, you know, thing for that place cue is we can make that such a good spot for them and, you know, put it off in a corner somewhere behind a baby gate, something like that. And then it also promotes, you know, some self-regulation and also, you know, it's a good spot where, like, if we're going to leave the pet home alone, we can put them in their really, you know, special safe space and they're comfortable there. So I think it's a good thing to have.
Should all dogs be trained?
Absolutely. But not to the extent that some people think, right? Like, a lot of my clients are like, oh, my God, your dogs must just be the best trained dogs ever. And I'm like, No, you're kidding, right? Like, I like functional behaviors. So, like, I'm not into rally and obedience and those types of things. I really want behaviors that serve a purpose, a touch cue so that I can get my dog to come to me and, you know, touch his nose to my hand, the place cue, right? So I can send it over there when I need to. Let's say I'm cooking in the kitchen and I'm cooking with things that are toxic to the dog. I want to send him away to his place. Like, I really like those functional type behaviors. I never teach like a shake cue at all. Like, I don't like that. It's my least favorite behavior because dogs then try and, you know, put their paw on you all the time. So I'm really about like functional living training.
And when you mean shake, you mean shake paws, not that the dog
comes
out of a bathtub shaking like dogs do to
Yes, you are exactly right. You're exactly right.
All right. So here's my question regarding that. To do any of those things, you need to connect with the dog. And to do that, well, some of it at some point in time can be done off leash. You really need a leash. You need the dog literally in some way connected to you. And there are all sorts of ways to do that. And you have a checklist here. And you have a green column, which is, these things are good. And then you have a big red X. Those things are no good. And under that, under that no good, I want to talk about each of those. You call it a remote collar, but this is essentially a shock collar.
Yeah, why
is that no good?
Yeah, so those tools in the red column are no good because they are aversive, and they are aversive to our best friend, and that's like the last thing that we would want to do. So what does it make, what about aversives makes them bad is it increases fear, anxiety, and stress. And so punishment absolutely can work. You know, if you slap my hand away from your cheesecake a number of times, I might stay away, but I'm not necessarily going to like you very much in the process, right? So I would much rather use tools and techniques that are kind and gentle to our animals, to our learners, because it's going to help you build a relationship. They're going to trust you more. It's just a better, humane way to live.
And in the case of a lot of these, actually all of these, in the big red X column, they potentially cause pain. Well, certainly the shock collar might do that.
Yep.
And people say, well, the setting can be low. Well, it can be.
Yeah.
But even then, are you really communicating by any of these pieces of equipment? And the others, by the way, are the chain link choke collar, the prong collar, which I mentioned way earlier in the program, which looks like a cartoon dog thing with with things poking out into the dog's neck. I want to talk also about the retractable leash. That's kind of a separate thing on its own. But all of these things, they have another thing in common. They never communicate to the dog what you do want.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. And so, you know, if the dog is just being punished all day, but it doesn't know exactly what you want it to do, that's not good information. That's like your boss telling you what not to do, but is not actually telling you what it is he wants you to do for your project, right? So that's a very frustrating, confusing way to work.
Well, you are a veterinary behaviorist, and that means you went to school, I don't know, 74,000 years or something like that. You took tests. I mean, really, it isn't easy to become who you are. And to me, And you know I feel this way, Dr. Pike, but it's not only that I feel this way. There's some truth to it, total truth to it, really. I mean, you are an absolute expert in animal behavior.
Thank you.
If you controlled the world, would you in fact even outlaw the prong collar, the choke collar?
Yeah.
You're ahead of me, and the shock collar.
Yeah, I absolutely would if I could control the world, just because we don't need them. They're, you know, and they're devices that cause harm to our animals, you know, whether that be emotional harm or, like you said, physical harm. I've seen, as a veterinarian, prong collar, you know, holes in the dog's skin, and I've seen shock collar burns on dog's skin, too. So, like, it's not just about the emotional pain that we're pain and suffering we're causing. We're also potentially causing physical pain and suffering, and I don't think that we should do that to animals. They deserve better.
Is there a crazy upside, though, when people use this equipment in that they need then to come to you or one of your colleagues? Either the dog had an issue in the first place, which is why the person is doing it, and maybe given bad advice or using a trainer that feels that that's going to help, or for whatever the reason, now maybe the dog didn't have an issue, but now does because of using.
Yeah.
Do you get more business as a result?
Yeah, it's a big business builder for me. You're right. I mean, unfortunately, that is true. It really is. We do see the fallout of these devices and techniques every single day in practice. I wish I could put myself out of business, honestly, by doing that. Now, dogs and cats and birds and horses will still have anxiety that I need to treat, but I would rather us not be causing anxiety, you know, in an untoward way.
Yep. And I want to talk about retractable leashes and much more with Dr.
Yeah.
Amy Pike when we come back on WGN. Some people still believe either that cats are like ornamental objects. Get one and the cat is so independent that he or she will do just fine without requiring all that much attention by family members. Or that cats are natural predators and require outdoor time and do what cats do best only if they are allowed to roam freely periodically outside. Well, the Feline Veterinary Medical Association offers now a simple statement. They just came out with this statement that indicated indoor cats must have the following: a safe place, provide multiple and separated key environmental resources. In other words, resources, whether they be high places to go or places to eat, places where toys are for each individual cat, litter boxes for each individual cat plus one, actually. So the rule is, if you have three cats, you need four litter boxes. Provide an opportunity for play and predatory behavior. Interactive play is truly the key, and provide positive, consistent, and predictable human-cat social interaction. Cats love that predictability. All right, this all makes sense, and I agree with the Feline Veterinary Medical Association. By saying this, what they're suggesting is that you can provide enough for cats if they're indoors only, which is something I've been saying for years and totally agree with. So why not outdoors? Why can't cats just do their thing outside? Well, cats who are outside, even if they're well-fed indoors, may still hunt. Now, the statistics about the number of cats eating songbirds are actually quite exaggerated. Cats do not fly, but they do kill songbirds. They kill vermin, too, which may be a good thing. But cats may also be bitten by what they attack and need veterinary care, or you might not notice, and then that bite gets infected, and cats actually sometimes get very sick as a result. Cats may wander off and get lost, especially older cats. If you allow the cat outdoors its entire life, then decide, well, for safety, I want my old cat to be indoors only. No one has explained to that old cat why you're now keeping that cat indoors only. And then, of course, there are predators outdoors, like birds of prey will kill cats, especially smaller ones, coyotes, cars. Yes, cars do hit cats. We are less likely, for some reason, I don't know why, to protect cats against parasites. So heartworm disease transmitted by mosquitoes, there's no treatment for that. Cytozoonosis is a tick disease which can be fatal. So in other words, what I'm saying is, if at all possible, please keep your cat indoors. Dr. Amy Pike is a veterinary behaviorist, along with Elizabeth Mullen, Tara Murtaugh, and illustrations by Finn Kendall. Together, they wrote the book, Dog Parenting, an illustrated guide to understanding, training, and bonding with your best friend. You know, I mentioned veterinary behaviorist before in the previous segment, Dr. Pike, but really didn't explain what that is. And I suspect some people still don't know. So who are you? What does that mean?
Yeah. I kind of equate us to the veterinary psychiatrist. So just like human psychiatrists, we are first and foremost doctors. So we had to do veterinary school, which, as you said, was probably 74,000 years of schooling. And then we have to do a residency, especially residency in behavior medicine. And that's where we learn everything that we need to know to practice behavioral medicine. And so, yeah, that's kind of vet behaviorist in a nutshell.
And, well, you left out a bunch, including writing papers, doing studies before you pass a board exam, which you have to do as well, right?
Yes, that is true. Yeah, you have to see at least 400 cases.
Whoa, 400? Wow.
Yeah, 400 cases in your residency. And I probably see just as many of those per year as a practicing vet behaviorist, too. So I've been doing this for a long time, so I see a lot of cases. And then we have to do original research. My research was on a supplement for thunderstorm phobias, and we have to publish case reports in journals, and then we have to take that dreaded exam, which was 2 days of absolute living hell.
But here you are.
Here I am on the other side.
Also the host of a co-host of a podcast, which is called?
Yeah. The Behavior Buzz.
The Behavior Buzz. So wherever your podcasts are
six
heard.
Z's.
So six Z's and Buzz?
Yep.
All right, I'll respell that. All right, so you said already, and we talked already, about how the, you were kind to say remote collar, but what they are shock collars, the choke collar, the chain link collars, the prong collar, and they're all on the no list. So is the retractable leash. Why is that on the, by the way, I would ban those too, by the way. I would add that to the list of things you could not buy. But why is that on?
I love it.
Yeah, I love it too, that we don't. Why shouldn't we?
Yeah, so retractable leashes, you know, they are fraught with problems. Number one, it's a very thin cord that I have seen snap numerous times. The other thing that I don't like about it is it takes a while for you to reel your dog back in. And so if your dog gets, you know, too close to another dog who becomes aggressive towards it, or your dog is aggressive towards that other dog, it's going to take you a little while to kind of reel that in like a fishing line, right? And then the other thing that I've seen happen is, you know, what if, God forbid, you drop the leash and now your dog has this clacking, clanking piece of plastic chasing after it, and it's going to keep running and running and running away from that scary thing. So we are all about fixed length leashes, you know, anywhere from 4 to 6 foot in length. And then if you are out hiking and you want to do, you know, or out on the beach or something like that, they make long lines, like, you know, 20, 30 feet long lines that you could use in those situations. I just don't think there's a need for a retractable leash.
I totally agree, and I can even add a little to it. So if the dog is way out there in front of you, who's walking who? Also, you have no idea what the dog is doing way out there. So the dog may pick up a chicken bone or something like that, something the dog, rodenticide. Anything that the dog isn't supposed to get into. And in an urban setting, and I've seen this happen multiple times, the dog turns the corner, but the person holding that big box retractable part is still way over there. And can't see what's going on. Yeah, now an aggressive dog has maybe gone after your dog, or maybe the other way around. Maybe you have the aggressive dog, but you have no way to know what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
which is why I. But then here's the question, Dr. Pike.
Mm-hmm.
We got to use something. What should we use?
Yeah. Yeah, so we can use head collars that are appropriately conditioned. We can use body harnesses that are, you know, designed to not allow the dog to pull physically. We can even just use a martingale collar with a fixed length leash. There's lots of options out there that work much better, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about this or hint at it more than talk about it really in the book. But you just said something about it earlier, and that is, okay, I want my dog trained. Do you think too many people, though, when they walk their dogs, I must have the dog at my side. The dog must be right there. And I say,
right.
Let the dog be a dog at times, too.
Yes, absolutely. My philosophy is the walk is for the dog, not for me. And so I let them sniff. Sorry, my dog is barking.
That's okay.
I let them sniff. I let them, you know, do dog things, right? I don't want them to just be a robot. And that's one of those behaviors that I think is worthless, is a heel behavior. Because if I need to get my dog near me for whatever reason, I'm going to use my touch cue, you know, or my watch me cue, anything like that, so that I can get them to look at me, essentially, and be near me if I need them to be. But otherwise, it's all about them. They can go do whatever they want.
Why is it that whenever you're doing a Zoom call or on a telephone interview, that's when the dogs bark? Otherwise, they
may
not.
That's when the dog barks. I know. He hasn't made a peep all day long.
It just always turns out to be that way, doesn't it?
In my life, there's always an animal doing something.
You've got enough of them. You know what?
Yeah.
That's okay. This is a pet show, so it works. The name of the book is called Dog Parenting, an illustrated guide to understanding, training, and bonding with your best friend, veterinary behaviorist Dr. Amy Pike is the co-author of the book, and we will talk more about the book and some issues. Such as resource guarding. What do you do about that? And she'll answer when we come back. She has seen everything. I think veterinary behaviorists do. You know what? I think the next book, Dr. Pike, should be Crazy Dog Parenting or something. I mean,
I love it. We actually talked about it, what our next book is going to be. So I'll jot that down.
Well, I mean, I did for years a Q&A column. And in one of the books I wrote, a chapter was the craziest questions I ever got, you know?
And I love it.
Yeah, you must have had some doozies, some situations over the years. But that's not what this book is. This book is called Dog Parenting, an illustrated guide to understanding, training, and bonding with your best friend. All right, I mentioned two words, resource guarding.
Mm-hmm.
It must be one of those things that you even clients come to you about. You address it in the book, too, and it's common, you know.
It is.
Yeah. So why does it occur, and what is resource guarding, and then what can be done about it?
Yeah, so, well, resource guarding is literally guarding of your resources, and for a dog, that could be its food bowl, its water bowl, its person, its spot on the bed, access to certain rooms, et cetera. And, you know, we need resources to live and to survive. And so it is a normal behavior, but when it comes to see me, the abnormality is that it is to an intensity level that is untenable in the home. And most often that's driven by anxiety, fear, and stress. So, you know, that is definitely something that we address in terms of how we treat resource guarding, is to address that underlying fear, anxiety, and stress. But then also, and something we didn't actually cover in the book because there just wasn't enough room, is oftentimes there's underlying gastrointestinal disease in many of these dogs that are resource guarding. So that's an important factor as well.
Right. And you have notes in the book essentially saying, don't try this at home in some cases.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
See the professionals and see a veterinarian to see what medically may be going on with the dog.
Yep.
Is the first step when we see dog-on-dog aggression or resource mm-hmm. guarding, which may include dog-on-person aggression or mm-hmm. dog-on-dog mm-hmm. aggression, to keep everyone safe before you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also the other thing is the more a dog practices, it's like getting mm-hmm. the Carnegie Hall, I suppose. The more the dog practices yeah. a behavior, the more the dog is going to do it.
Absolutely. Practice makes perfect. So, yeah, management is the first step in treating any behavior problem, including resource guarding, because we want to keep everybody safe. We want to avoid practicing that behavior, and we want to really reduce the stress that's associated with that behavior, so that because nobody can learn when they're too stressed out. And so that's going to be one way that we're going to mitigate that stress as well.
One of those behaviors that must drive you crazy. There you are, Dr. Pike. You're at a cocktail party, and mm-hmm. and you walk into the room, and the dog, a happy dog, but a big dog, jumps on you mm-hmm. because the dog is so happy to see you. Mm-hmm. And then the owner comes and puts a knee into, and this was common,
yeah.
about, it still is, I think, puts the
it
knee
still
up,
is, unfortunately.
Yeah, into the dog's chest. Well, indeed mm-hmm. it works to get the dog down.
Yeah.
But I believe you write that is not your preferred method.
Yeah, definitely not the preferred method. Yeah. So again, it just tells the dog what not to do. It doesn't tell them exactly what you want them to do instead, but also it can create fear of whoever's putting that knee in the chest, and we don't want to do that. We also could very easily injure our pet by doing that. And, we just want to teach it, you know, when you greet visitors, what do we want you to do instead? And that's keep your booty or all four legs on the floor, right? So we're not jumping up.
Mm-hmm, absolutely right. But sometimes it's easier said. I mean, here we are on the radio saying, well, you
sure.
can do the... Sometimes it is easier said than done.
Jumping up is one of those behaviors that's really fun for the dog, right? So it is definitely highly motivated to want to jump up. So again, you can manage it. You can put the dog away, you know, while guests come in. And then once guests are seated, you can let the dog out, let them greet calmly. We can put a leash on the dog and, you know, actually have some physical restraint of the dog during greetings. So there's lots of stuff we can do to help prevent that practice.
And I have an idea. It comes from your book, and it comes from you. Because you mentioned it earlier, you know, we talked about giving mm-hmm. the dog his or her specific place to go. Well, maybe mm-hmm. the dog goes to that place when the doorbell rings.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is exactly what we teach in my house is the doorbell rings. You go sit in the living room, which is off to the side of the door, so that way I can open it safely with everybody.
You must have a big living room with all the dogs you have.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's okay, you know. And are they able to do it? And are they able to go to their own specific place? Or do they fight over where the place is?
Yeah, no. So in my household, it's just a general location. This is not a specific place cue, but we just paired the doorbell with go into the carpeted area, essentially. So they all can just kind of be wherever they want to in that room.
Well, the name of the book is called Dog Parenting. It's an illustrated guide to understanding, training, and bonding with your best friend. I want to go back and say part of that again, bonding with your best friend. Do you find that sometimes, and this is one of those questions that only I would ask, I guess, but sometimes you meet the client, meet the dog, and you say, you know what? This is crazy. This is a wonderful dog. This person's a wonderful person. It's just not a good match. Does that ever happen?
Yeah. It absolutely happens. So that is the dog that you heard barking, actually, Bailey, is a lovely dog. He is the sweetest thing on the face of the planet, but he does not like strangers coming, which is what exactly just happened right now as somebody came up to my office door. And He unfortunately lived with some clients who were having to move into assisted living, and they were going to have nurses come in and out all the time, and it just was not going to be a good fit. And so it's okay to say that this is not the right dog for us. Now, Bailey is a mini schnauzer, and I'm mini schnauzer obsessed, and so that's why I agreed to take him. But, you know, it can be hard to find a different home, especially for a dog with significant behavioral challenges, but again, it's okay to say that this isn't the right fit for either one of us, because I want to make sure quality of life is good for everybody involved, the human and the dog.
And I would argue that agree that a good percent of dogs in shelters are just there for that reason. I mean, they never found you, and they're, I mean, but this is not a bad dog. It's just not the right situation at the right time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Once again, the name of the book is Dog Parenting. A veterinary behaviorist writes any book. I say get the book. This one is no different. It's a small book. It's easy to read.
It is.
It's jam-packed with great information. And it's non-scientific the way you write it, Dr. Pike. I mean, this is practical advice, I think, that anyone can follow. You weren't alone. Your co-authors, Elizabeth Mullen and Tara Murtaugh. Illustrations, which are fun and helpful, by Finn Kendall. And, you know, for someone who can't draw anything, I really respect that.
Same.
Again, the name of the book is Dog Parenting. Dr. Amy Pike, thank you so much. The American Animal Hospital Association accredits veterinary practices. Not all of them. Only those that pass a certain rigorous test, really, to be the best. They really look for the best of the best. And among those qualifications, if you will, are all sorts of things. But now there are three new ones. That practice will not devocalize or debark dogs. Do surgery, which is medically unnecessary, to take away the dog's ability to bark. Ear cropping, that's a big one. The American Kennel Club has not said either of those things are wrong, but now the American Animal Hospital Association is doing that. And declawing, which is not only a matter of clipping the cat's nails, but actually it's an amputation. So I am so glad the American Animal Hospital Association is stepping up. Arguably, late is better than never. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early on WGN.